members vote or desire to vote?
Members, this budget is not our preference.
Share the pain.
We've got to stop the games.
No baloney.
Taxes, taxes, taxes.
The next step's the governor's.
Only the good Lord knows.
Mr. Secretary, call the roll.
I'm Jeffrey Callison. Those political sounds and voices mean it's time for Capital Chat, our weekly discussion on Insight about what's going on in government. Usually we focus on the California government in Sacramento, but this week we're going to the U.S. Capitol. Central Valley farmers are paying close attention to the latest farm bill working its way through Congress. And historically, California, with its huge ag business, gets less than you might expect from the farm bill. What will California farms and ranchers get this time? And what impact, if any, is the deficit supercommittee having on this? Joining us from Washington is reporter Matt Laszlo. Matt, welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how far along is the farm bill?
Well, that's the thing. It doesn't need to be reauthorized until next year. But with all the attention on this deficit-reducing supercommittee that's looking for $1.2 to $1.5 trillion in spending cuts, members on both sides, House and Senate of the Agriculture Committees, are sending their recommendations very early to this supercommittee. And that's causing a little bit of a ruckus because people are saying, hey, we want this to be debated out in the open. And right now, a lot of people aren't having the usual say they would have in this massive, massive funding bill.
You say that both sides of the Agriculture Committee are sending their proposals to the Deficit Supercommittee. What do we know about those different proposals?
Well, all we know is that they've reached a consensus that they want to cut $23 billion in farm subsidies and other programs, including food stamps and other things. The President Obama had wanted $33 billion in cuts, so it makes sense that the congressional people in charge are saying, no, we want a little bit less than that to protect their home state subsidies. But what they were supposed to send on November 1st specific recommendations for the cuts. And right now it looks like there isn't consensus between Democrats and Republicans on these different ag committees in the Senate and House on what specifically they want cut.
So, but they have agreed, the Democrats and the Republicans, that they're going to suggest $23 billion worth of cuts.
Yeah. So right now there's only consensus on the number. But what it looks like they're haggling over is whether to cut, say, more from conservation programs, which the Republicans want, or to cut more from food assistance programs, which the Republicans in their budget earlier this year in the House also went after. Democrats are saying, hey, let's maybe restructure some of these subsidy programs that in the past have gone more to boost wheat, soybeans, and corn, and are saying, hey, let's get more money to specialty crops like California's fruits and vegetables and the like.
We're talking about the farm bill, which is due to be authorized next year, and how the work of the deficit supercommittee might affect the amount of funding for agriculture coming out of Washington. My guest is Matt Laszlo, Washington, D.C.-based reporter. $23 billion is a lot of money if that ends up being the amount that's cut from the farm bill. But the farm bill itself is, of course, much, much larger than that. This is probably less than 10% of the total.
Yeah, oh, it's a massive bill. In 2008, it was $288 billion over 5 years. So $23 billion, it's significant. But a lot of people, a lot of critics of what they call out-of-control government spending have long said we need massive reforms in the nation's agriculture policy. They kind of look at this bill as a giveaway. The reason you get such broad bipartisan consensus on the farm bill each year is because there's basically what amounts to handouts to every state. So even fiscal conservatives who usually want to cut very deeply still want to protect those home state sweeteners.
Well, yeah, I was just going to ask you about that because you said that both the Democrats and the Republicans in Congress had agreed that $23 billion should be cut. But the president, who's a Democrat, wanted $33 billion cut. How do the Republicans square their preference for a smaller cut, given their usual preference for cutting more out of government, or the stated preference?
Well, everyone realizes now, in a perfect world, you'd be plussing up this program. There's important things to both sides. But everyone realizes this is a time of fiscal austerity, that deep cuts need to happen to get the nation solvent again. So Democrats are conceding more than they would like to up front. But again, it gets down to the specifics. They want to restructure some of these subsidy programs instead of what they would say is just giving handout to especially corn and wheat farmers. So they'd like to see plussed up and a restructuring of this bill so that fruits and vegetables, nutrition programs, food stamp programs get more money. So, as always, the devil is in the details. And again, that's why people are very frustrated with these committees sending this to the super committee instead of having this debated out in the open.
As I understand, a lot of the product support money in the Farm Bill supports the big grain-type crops that are traditionally grown in the Midwest, and the kinds of crops that are grown more in California, the fruits and nuts, get less. And that's part of the reason, at least, why California gets a disproportionately smaller part of the Farm Bill, despite the fact that it has a gigantic agriculture industry. Is that a fair summary?
That is a fair summary, and one thing that needs to be noted is when this was reauthorized in 2008, California farmers and other farmers out west won some major concessions. They got $3 billion in 2008 for a specialty crop title, which was a big step forward for farmers out in California. The specialty crop title includes fruits, nuts, and vegetables, and there was also a $1 billion provision over a decade to increase funding for fresh fruit and vegetable snack programs in schools and the like. So that was a major concession. And one thing farmers in California want to protect now going forward is that title. And yet some Republicans are saying, we don't want the government dictating what local schools are serving. So again, we get back to these debates we always have.
My guest for this week's Capital Chat is Matt Laszlo. He's a Washington, D.C.-based reporter, and he joins us from the studios of public radio station WAMU in Washington, D.C. The Farm Bill is only due to be reauthorized next year, but because of the deficit supercommittee's work, which has to wrap up before the end of this year, and it's taking a broad look at government programs across the board, the Farm Bill issues are being raised right now. But you said earlier that people are concerned that because of this part of the story, the super committee, that things are not going to be debated in the open as much as they would do if they were discussed as part of the usual committee process for the Farm Bill. Why would that be the case? Why would not they not be debated in the open if the cuts are made by the deficit super committee?
Because that's one of the big criticisms of this super committee. This is going outside of the regular committee order. So instead of having public hearings, and the super committee, in their defense, they've had three or four now public hearings, but they're not in those hearings debating the nitty gritty details that a fruit farmer in California cares about. That's usually debated and represented by three powerful California lawmakers who are keeping a very close eye on agriculture and their home state products. And one thing we should also remind listeners, when this was debated back in 2008, this was vetoed once. It was extended for 8 months on a short-term basis. It was filibustered by Republicans in the Senate back then. So this is a very, very hot topic. And yet this time, they're just sending the recommendations in private to a private committee. And this has farmers across the board up in arms.
Given that the super committee is talking about money in, I guess, perhaps even in the trillions over a period of 10 years, there's no way they can be saying, no, let's give strawberry farmers $5 million instead of $10 million in the year 2015. They must be talking in very broad terms.
Yes and no. When this committee's done, they could send out what would regularly be just an appropriation bill, a regular spending bill. So they can have itemized deductions or deep spending cuts that are very specific. They can also have broader recommendations that they might send to another committee, like the Tax Writing Committee, and say, all right, can you go and overhaul the tax code? Look at the best ways for us to reform this program broadly. But the committee does have the power to get very specific. And that's why local lawmakers are upset, because they're saying, wait, we want to have a say on those, what you on the East Coast might think is a very minute point to us is night and day. It's vital for our local farmers.
It sounds like a hugely ambitious project, what the super committee is trying to do, because in effect, they're to a certain extent, they're doing appropriations for the next 10 years in a period of a couple of months.
Yes, and they're charged with looking at everything. That's Department of Defense, that's Medicare, that's Social Security, this is Medicaid. So these are vital national security questions that these 12 members are debating. It's also vital social programs that a lot of Americans depend on. And it's also the whole issue of revenue and whether the nation needs to increase taxes or decrease taxes or reform the entire tax code, which some people are talking about. So the task in front of them is massive. The nation has never really witnessed something like this. There's been similar things in the past, but this is a very substantial task on these 12 members' plate, and it's definitely not an enviable task.
If they do not achieve the task they've been given, then there would be, at least in theory, across-the-board cuts throughout the federal government. And although there's also talk about maybe waiving some of those cuts should it come to that. But what's the word right now in Washington, as far as you can tell? Are people expecting the super committee to actually come up with a proposal that would achieve the cuts that they were given to find?
Every budget analyst I've talked to is more cynical than I am. And as a reporter, I didn't think that was possible. But from all the analysts I'm talking to, there's just a deep sense of pessimism here in Washington that this committee can reach this grand bargain or even a small bargain. This week, there was a little headway. You had the Republicans on the committee, a handful of them, put on the table $300 billion in new revenues from reforming the tax code. That's seen by many analysts and even by Democrats as a big step forward. But Democrats on the committee are saying we'd rather see $1 trillion in new revenues as opposed to $300 billion. And the Republicans on the committee, in exchange for that $300 billion, they also want to extend the Bush tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans. So Democrats are saying, you guys are playing politics here, pretending to give a concession, but not going nearly far enough.
Matt Laszlo, Washington, D.C.-based reporter, joining us today for Capital Chat. We've been talking about the deficit super committee, in particular agriculture money that could be cut by the super committee as we look towards the farm bill for next year. Matt Laszlo, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for your time.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, a program that helps disabled former military members start businesses. They're now reaching out into remote parts of California. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Joining us now with Insight Online is Insight's assistant producer, James Morrison. Hi, James.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Well, yesterday on Insight, we talked about student loans. Afterwards, we got a big response on our Facebook page, Insight on Capital Public Radio. Dixie asked us, what is the name of the new Obama program for student loan repayment evaluation, the one based on having more debt than earnings per year? Income-based repayment is the name of that program. I've posted a link on our webpage, capradio.org/insight. It has all the details about the program and a calculator to see if you're eligible. Also, a former Insight guest, David Kolchek, posted on our Facebook page after yesterday's student loan discussion. He wrote, I owe $30,000 for 2 years at Sac State. It never ends with these guys. Well, we were curious how a person racks up $30,000 in debt in 2 years at Sacramento State.
Good question.
So we called David, and this is what he said.
I don't know. You know, I got this form in the mail about the student loans, and that's what they told me that's how much I have. It must be with interest and everything else they threw in. I was completely paid off my student loans when I came into Sac State, and they sent me a letter at the beginning of the semester saying that I'm $30,000 in debt to them already.
Okay.
Also, a programming note. Carmichael pianist Kevin Young was on the show earlier this week. During that interview, we said you could hear him this weekend on NPR's From the Top. That show will air nationally this weekend. However, it won't be broadcast on our station until the following Sunday, November 20th.
Thanks, James.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Well, it's Veterans Day, of course, and in this part of today's show, we'll focus on veterans. A little later in the program, a play inspired by a true and tragic story of a Vietnam veteran who had PTSD. But first, we'll hear how disabled veterans overcome challenges to start their own businesses. In California, there's a program that supports them. It's called the Disabled Veteran Business Alliance. And joining us is Executive Director of the Alliance, Rich Dryden. Rich, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
How many veterans return to civilian life each year in California, and how many are permanently disabled?
About 30,000 every year come back, stay in California after they leave the service. We're going to, the figures talk about 25 to 30. I'm going to guess it's going to be greater than 50% in today's types of conflicts.
And those are disabilities of many kinds, correct? Give us examples of the kinds of disabilities we're talking about.
Well, just as you just mentioned, certainly any traumatic stress syndrome, PTSD, and one of the more common in today's conflict is traumatic brain injury. And that's a problem, obviously, that we're going to have to deal with.
And that was less common in the past because oftentimes people who had those kinds of injuries died on the battlefield or soon after. But nowadays, because of advances in medical technology, they're surviving, but they still have this disability. How does that affect people's ability to start and run a business?
That's a really good question. What we're finding is that it's certainly difficult for employers to be comfortable with hiring people. After the Fort Hood incident, you might remember there was an article in the LA Times about an employer who just couldn't hire a disabled veteran that was on medication and had to do counseling because they felt uncomfortable. And while there are techniques to overcome that, in this particular case, I can understand it. One of the things that we're pursuing is a program to match these disabled veterans with traumatic brain injuries to specific types of business models and put them in business. We think working for themselves is a lot easier than working for someone who may be uncomfortable with them.
And when you say uncomfortable, are you referring to the concern that some people might have that this disabled veteran might snap, quote unquote?
Sure. I mean, that's a reality. That's not something we can turn our heads on. That's possible. We've seen it happen. But it's very, very isolated. I think when it happens one time, it looks like it happens a lot, but that's not the case.
My guest is Rich Dryden of the Disabled Veteran Business Alliance. By the way, you're a veteran yourself, correct?
Vietnam veteran, yes, I am.
Yes. And did you suffer any disabilities as a result?
I have a hearing disability.
I see. Is that why you got into this line of work?
Well, it's really become a passion for me. I think working with disabled veterans, giving them an opportunity to really reunite themselves back into their local communities and be positive forces, be taxpayers, be employers. That's a real piece of the goodness of what our nonprofit does, and I really enjoy representing it.
And who pays for your nonprofit?
We have huge corporate support. It's all corporate. There's no membership cost of any of our guests, to any of our members. AT&T, Genentech, McKesson, huge corporations, and we have 8 or 9 of our own disabled veterans that are annual supporters as well.
And specifically, what do you do to support these disabled veterans who want to start their own businesses?
We do everything but lend them money. We take them through the process of business planning, and then we add into that the fact that there are goals both in corporate America and the government entities that want to use these businesses. We assist them with opportunities, and we have avenues to money lenders that will help, but we don't have that type of pocket that we'd like to have. But we take them all the way through it, and we also do a lot of oversight on the program here, the DVBE program that you mentioned before, legislatively.
You said that you do everything but lend money, and then you said that you just don't have that kind of pocket. So is that just because you don't have those resources available, or is there some other reason why you don't want to get into lending money?
Well, yeah, lending money is as you know, in today's market is a problematic place to go, and it wouldn't really fit with what we do as a nonprofit. But we have partners, and we have people that are very good at helping getting Patriot loans and some of the loans that the Small Business Administration has. So it's better for us to move people in that direction rather than to have the money ourselves.
But isn't money one of the biggest challenges of all for people starting up their own business?
You bet it is, of course. And in today's market, with some of these veterans coming home, they're able to get assistance from their family. And it doesn't take a lot to start up a business, but it does take some. And to get a $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $25,000 loan is difficult in today's market, as you know.
We're talking about a program to help disabled veterans start their own businesses. My guest is Rich Dryden. Give us examples of the kinds of companies, the more common types of companies that disabled veterans are starting.
Construction, information technology, consulting, a lot of consulting groups out. It's nice that you can find those kinds of avenues to pursue. Commodity sales, many types of commodities, especially today, green products. A lot of businesses are in that. Here locally, we have a business that can do underground radar work for sites. It's amazing. I mean, we have a real variety.
And are these disabled veterans typically making use of skills they learned when they were in the military?
I think so. Many do, and that's good because they're well structured. They can run a good business. And in today's market, young men and women coming out, you know, obviously internet familiar. The internet's a great place to run a business, and they're good. They can even build their own website, so they get a quick start.
Earlier this week, we talked with a couple of veterans who are now at university, and even for a veteran who did not serve in a combat zone, who did not suffer any disabilities, it can be a bit of an adjustment to make, to put it mildly, to come back to civilian life from the military. I can only imagine how much more of a challenge it is if you're coming from a combat zone, if you have some kind of disability. Do you actually reach out to veterans who have just come back, or do they have to be at a point where they've made that decision they're going to start a business before they get to you?
It happens both ways. Certainly, we like to get to the transition assistant points when they come out, meet them, and at least make sure they understand that this is a slice of the pie that a lot of people don't know about. You know, we're hearing all the time, hire a veteran. There's many organizations out there that are helping to employ, but the piece of the pie that we provide is be your own employer, run your own business, employ people, have the opportunity to rehabilitate yourself back into civilian life positively and take care of your family financially. And owning a business is a great way to do that.
What was it like for you when you came out of the military as a veteran and with a disability?
The disability hasn't, with most veterans, been that much of a problem. When I got out of the military, I went right into a business. In fact, it was a business with all veterans, and was pretty simple. So I can't speak for those that have major injuries, traumatic brain injury, because that's something that we're really just starting to take a closer look at. We're looking at now, as I said, developing a program to match business models to those, and maybe they'll work at home, you know, those type of things, but something that fits what their capabilities are. And of course, it's really for those that have some type of business acumen and really want to go into owning their own business.
Unfortunately, we've all heard of some stories of people claiming military service that did not actually happen to them. What do you do to ensure that everything's above board? In other words, that the people receiving support are, in fact, disabled veterans?
Well, California runs the real gold standard in programs. We work very closely with the Department of General Services to ensure that these businesses are not fraudulent, that they actually run the business, and that they are veterans. And that's been a problem nationally, because nationally, the service-disabled veteran-owned businesses were self-certified, and we're going to guess that over 50% were fraudulent, but that's now being taken apart piece by piece, and there are some very substantial laws that have been put into place and some very severe penalties for those that we find that are fraudulent here in California, and we monitor that very closely.
And Rich, I also read that your organization is doing more outreach into remote areas of California, meaning what?
Right. We have what we call a rolling chapter program. We have chapters developed here in Sacramento, down in Southern California, three chapters in that area, and one in the Bay Area. That's a little bit easier because it takes a real volunteer force to do that. But the areas like this week, we were in Fortuna, up in the Eureka area. We've been to El Centro. We try to get to these areas, Santa Barbara, which are hard to get to, and actually roll in with a chapter meeting, meet as many disabled veterans as we can, or any veterans. We won't turn any veterans away, and see what they want to do, and then give them the options and introduce ourselves so that they know we're here to help.
And if any disabled veterans are listening and they've got a business idea, what should they do?
Please check our website at www.cadvbe.org or call our office at 916-446-3510, and you can get up with someone 24/7.
Rich Dryden, Executive Director of the California Disabled Veteran Business Alliance. Thanks so much for joining us today, Rich.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, a play telling the true but tragic story of a Vietnam vet with PTSD is running in Sacramento. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. What's in the news today? The man with the answer is Alan Ray, Capital Public Radio's news editor. He's in our newsroom. Alan, what's in the news?
Well, good morning, Jeffrey. The California Public Utilities Commission votes to investigate whether Pacific Gas and Electric broke state or federal pipeline regulations in the years leading up to last year's fatal San Bruno explosion. In the next few months, agency investigators will be testifying before an administrative law judge about the company's actions before that explosion. On September 9, 2010, a pipeline rupture blew up, killed 8 people, destroyed 38 homes in San Bruno. Used to be in the wisdom of the markets, you bought on the rumor and sold on the news. Not this time. U.S. investment indexes are all up, the big three up more than 2%, the Dow Industrial Average up more than 270 points. Why, you wonder? Well, all because it looks like the Eurozone crisis has passed for now. Italy's parliament has begun hurry-up work on an austerity plan demanded by the European Union. Once the changes are approved, the way will be clear for the end of the political line, it looks, for the Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. And the Greek government will now be led out of the Euro wilderness by a former European central banker. Lucas Papademos has been sworn in as the new prime minister there. The markets all like it. We'll get a recap of the day from NPR on All Things Considered beginning at 3:30 this afternoon on Capital Public Radio.
Alan Ray, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Medal of Honor Rag is a play telling the fictionalized but underlying true but tragic story of a Vietnam veteran who had been awarded the Medal of Honor, but on return to civilian life was diagnosed with depression, was consistent with PTSD. That man, Dwight Johnson, died after he was shot during an armed robbery at a convenience store in Detroit. This play, Medal of Honor Rag, is running right now in Sacramento, and joining us in our studio are two of the actors in the show and the play's director. And we'll start with her. She's Janice Stevens. Janice, welcome back to Insight.
Hi, Jeffrey. Good to be here.
Well, you are directing Medal of Honor Rag. Tell us about this play. It's not a new play.
No, it was written during the Vietnam War period by Tom Cole. And you've clearly stated what it was based on. Tom Cole was an Army veteran himself. And it's a one act. I mean, it's, you know, one scene. It's about 70 minutes long, and it's in real time. And you are privy to, as the audience, seeing DJ Dale Jackson in a therapy session with a new psychiatrist who is a specialist in grief management, and who is trying to help, especially the guys who've come back from Vietnam, who've been given the Medal of Honor, the Congressional Medal of Honor, cope with PTSD and trying to get to the bottom of it.
Is this an anti-war play?
I think so.
Yeah. Joining us in the with us along with us are the actors Patrick Murphy and Isaac Williams, who played two key roles in this show. Patrick Murphy, who do you play?
I'm a psychiatrist.
Okay. And Isaac?
I play Del Jackson. Goes by DJ.
DJ, who is inspired by this real-life man who was shot during the armed robbery. How is he different, your character?
How is he different from
the real-life? Yeah, from the real-life character.
Well, that's an interesting question.
Well, because he's given a different name, that's what I'm saying.
He is.
So how different is he otherwise from the real-life character, if he is at all?
I think the thing is that he's supposed to be pretty similar. It's based off him. You know, he is a fictional character, but I think he's dealing with all the same problems that the real man did. So,
yeah. And Patrick, the psychiatrist, is that a real character too?
As far as I know.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Janice, was this a play you were familiar with?
Yes, it is. I have been teaching acting out at American River College for a number of years now as an adjunct professor, and I've been using scenes and monologues from this play for a number of years. And Isaac took a private acting class that I was doing over at the R and 25th Streets Arts Complex this last spring, and I assigned him this scene with another gentleman in the class, and Ray Tatter came to see the final presentations of the scenes. And
Ray being the artistic director
Ray
of California Stage, which is putting
on
the show.
Yes, indeed, and the producer. And he saw the scene, and he said, that's the play I want to open my 20th anniversary season with as an homage to all of the guys who are coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq.
Isaac, do you have any personal connection to people serving?
I do have some extended family members who are in the services, but my immediate family has not served. Yes. So, yes and no.
Yeah. And this play is set in the time before you were born, I'm guessing.
Definitely.
How does it resonate with you, the play?
It's relevant to me because, you know, there is, you know, an Iraq war and a war in Afghanistan. So I think there's clear connections between, you know, the way we take care of our vets when they come back, whether it was Vietnam or, you know, Afghanistan. So
yes. Patrick Murphy, you before you returned to Sacramento, you were an acting teacher for many years.
That's correct.
How well-known is Medal of Honor RAG in theater circles?
This is the first I've heard of it.
The first you've heard of it?
Yes, I know a production was done on NPR when it was first written, but I didn't see that
didn't
production.
That.
Yes, yeah. Which is not available, incidentally.
Yes, Janice, if I may, we went to Isaac because you seemed that there was something was troubling you a little bit when we were talking about the war. Do you mind telling us what was going on in your mind?
Oh, because you know I'm one of the oldies from the whole Vietnam era and. My God, I remember my dad getting my boyfriend a job at the time so that he wouldn't have to, you know, go off to Canada. I mean, this play brings up a lot of memories, and it seems to bring up a lot of memories and visceral experiences for everybody who's seeing it. Even my students who've come to see it, who are Isaac's age, are saying things like going back home and talking to their grandfather about the era and... It's pulling up conversations that are pertinent, absolutely pertinent to what we're going to go through here today.
We're talking about Medal of Honor RAG. It's a play, a fictionalized version of a true story about a Vietnam veteran who was diagnosed with PTSD, essentially, and he died during an armed robbery. And this play is running through November 27th in the Threepenny Theater at the R25 Arts Complex in Midtown Sacramento, presented by California Stage. And my guests are Janice Stevens, who's directing, and Patrick Murphy and Isaac Williams, who are acting in it. And we're going to hear a scene from the play. Janice, could you tell us where we are in the show?
Fairly close to the beginning when the psychiatrist and DJ are kind of feeling each other out and finding out what is this new relationship going to be with this therapist. So, and this scene pretty much presents all of the themes in the play.
Okay, thank you.
You some big-time specialist?
In a manner of speaking.
What are you a specialist in?
I do a lot of work with Vietnam veterans and their problems.
Well, I can see that, man, but what do you specialize in?
I specialize in grief.
Shit, come on.
Impacted grief. That's the special area I work in.
I'm going to spend another hour in jive and riddles and double talk. Only it's not really an hour, right? It's like impacted.
Ah, you know the word, impacted.
How dumb do you think I am?
I don't think you're dumb at all. As a matter of fact, the reverse. The subject is bright. His Army GT rating is the equivalent of 128 IQ. In first interviews, he does not volunteer information. He related he grew up in a Detroit ghetto and never knew his natural father. He sort of laughed when he said he was a good boy and always did what was expected of him. He was an explorer scout and an altar boy.
The other doctor talked a lot about depression.
What did he say about it?
He said I had it.
Oh, and?
He thought I ought to get rid of it, you know?
Hmm.
Yeah, well, he was the chief doctor here. The chief doctor for all the psychos at Valley Forge Army Hospital.
Valley Forge.
Yeah.
Why don't you get rid of it?
Sometimes that's just what I want to do. Sometimes I just want to throw it in their faces. Now, ain't that stupid? Like whose face?
What do you want to throw in their faces?
What are we talking about?
What are you talking about? I was talking about depression. You said your doctor said you should try to get rid of it. And I asked simply, why don't you get rid of it? You meant the metal, didn't you, when you said, throw it in their faces?
Well, that's why you're here, right? Because of the metal.
But I didn't bring it up. You did.
You asked me why I don't get rid of it.
I was talking about depression.
No, you meant the metal.
You meant the metal. I never mentioned it. Are you glad you have it?
The depression?
No. No, the metal.
Oh, man. Oh, my. Suppose I didn't have that metal. You wouldn't be here, right? You wouldn't know me from a hole in the wall. I mean, I would be invisible to you. Like 100,000 other dudes who got themselves sent over there to be shot at by a lot of little Chinamen hiding up in the trees. I mean, you're some famous doctor, right? Because you know I'm a special case. Well, I am. I am one big tidbit. I'm what you call a hot property in this man's army. Yes, sir. I am an authentic hero. A showpiece. One look at me, enlistments go up 200%. I'm a credit to my race. Did you know that? I am an honor to the city of Detroit, to say nothing of the state of Michigan, of which I am the only living Medal of Honor winner. I'm a feather in the cap of the army, a flower in the lapel of the military. I mean, I am quoting to you, man. That is what they say at banquets given in my honor. And look at me. Look at me.
Wow, what a tremendous scene and a tremendous performance by Isaac Williams and Patrick Murphy in our studio. Janice Stevens, that's great stuff, isn't it? The script and the performance.
Yes, it is. Yeah. I'm very proud of this piece. I want everybody to come and see it.
It sounds to me like this is a scene where both characters are sitting there talking to each other. So this is the kind of scene where the words of the script and the performances of the actors are pretty much all that there is. How do you handle that as a director?
Yeah, that is an issue because, you know, we all know that just having two people sitting across a desk from each other for 70 minutes is probably not going to be fully engaging, no matter how important the words are. We've done some great blocking with this show. There's a lot of variation. It is not static by any means. When DJ chooses to sit down with the doctor, very important moment, right? And when the doctor chooses to open up some of his past, which we find out he's had some Holocaust background, the relationship, you get to see a real progression in it. Yeah.
And Isaac, this must be a very powerful moment for you to be reading this character. That's what I'm picking up just watching you and listening to you.
It is. There's various moments throughout the play. They're not the same moment. They're always different. You know, I wasn't there. I don't pretend to know. So I just, you know, I'm just trying to really connect to what's in the writing, you know. And I've done my research, try to put those together and perform.
I made him watch, you know, Platoon and Full Metal Jacket and everything else that I could think of to get him hooked into that. And he's done
massacre.
A brilliant job of it.
Wow.
Both of these guys, brilliant actors. It's been a real pleasure.
I can imagine. Well, Medal of Honor RAG runs through November 27th at the R25 Arts Complex in Midtown Sacramento, presented by California Stage. Janice Stevens is the director, and Patrick Murphy and Isaac Williams, actors. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Cool. Thank you.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, an artist born in Jamaica, raised in Sacramento, now living in Beijing, is back in the capital city with an exhibit of his paintings from China. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callis, and here's your weather. In the Valley today, it'll be partly sunny with a chance of showers reaching 63 in Sacramento. And in Sacramento tonight, women who are interested in traveling solo are invited to a free workshop at the Sacramento Hostel, that Victorian mansion downtown. The workshop is about traveling safely and autonomously. The presenters are two local women with a lot of experience traveling the world solo. It starts at 6:30. Otherwise, in weather, 63 in Yuba City, 61 in Davis, 65 in Modesto, 54 in Nevada City, 57 in Sparks, and 47 in Tahoe City. Mostly cloudy tomorrow and mostly sunny on Sunday. An artist who was born in Jamaica and raised in Sacramento, now lives part of the time in Beijing, is back in the capital city. There's an exhibit of his paintings showing at the JJ Art Gallery. These are paintings inspired by his time in China. He's Peter Wayne Lewis, and he's in our studio. Peter Wayne Lewis, thanks for joining us in Sacramento.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Yes. How did you come to follow that path in life, moving around from one country to another?
Oh, that's actually quite interesting. You know, having been born in Jamaica, you know, immigrated in 1962 to Sacramento, California. And, you know, right now, I mean, I teach in New England and I have a studio in New York, you know, where I live with my wife. And as it turns out, the college where I teach, we actually have an exchange program with an institution in Beijing. So I traveled to China with students as an exchange. And, I mean, I'd been hearing about the exciting art world, you know, in Beijing. So, you know, as we move through Beijing and you're going into artist studios and just kind of seeing the excitement and energy, you know, in Beijing, I just got really stimulated and excited by that whole experience. So after that trip with the students, I decided to actually build a studio in Beijing.
Wow.
And I do go over maybe about three times a year and maybe spend about 3 months to actually paint on site, you know, in Beijing.
What do you get as an artist out of being there and being inspired by what you're experiencing?
Well, I think for all human beings, I think direct information is always the best. You can sit down and, you know, you can read a book, a novel, hear a poem. But I think at the same time, to really be in a place where you can smell, breathe the air, eat the food, and just look at the people, you know, directly, I think that's the best way to really find out what a culture is actually about.
How do you handle the language? Do you speak the local dialect?
That's actually a good thing. I think right now the Chinese are really trying to learn to speak English. So everyone is really interested in trying to pick up a few words, you know. So I don't really speak Mandarin, but I am, you know, extremely interested in trying to, you know, pick up a few words, you know, each time I actually go over. But it is a bit of a struggle, but you just sort of use, you know, the information that you have and, you know, the skills, you know, that you have and just trying to speak. There's a lot of hand gestures, you know, things like that. Yeah.
My guest is the artist Peter Wayne Lewis. There's an exhibit of his paintings at the JJ Art Gallery in Sacramento. It's running through almost the end of the year, and there's an artist's reception this Saturday evening, which is second Saturday. That's November 12th, starting at 6 o'clock. There's a photograph of Peter on our webpage, capradio.org/insight, and it's a sort of an overhead view of you in a gallery with paintings on the walls. Where is that?
This is actually the studio that I have in Beijing, and I built this space.
It's big.
It's about, yeah, it's 5,000 square feet. And actually, it's really, for me, it was a really cost-effective move. What I've done is sort of built a dream studio in Beijing. So, in fact, the building is divided into three areas, and I actually host exhibition of local Chinese artists as well as artists that I brought over from the United States. So what you're looking at right now is actually some work that I actually did in June, July of this year in the space. So at any time, you know, people can actually come in and actually look at the work that's actually on display. And there are events that happens, you know, in that studio.
The paintings that are being shown in Sacramento, are any of them from your studio that we can see in this picture?
Everything. The title of the exhibition is Works from Middle Earth. Middle Earth is what the Chinese call, you know, their ground, you know, their land. So all of the paintings that's going to be on exhibit at JJ Gallery tomorrow was made in that studio. So this is actually the premiere of the work that I've been doing in China over the last 5 years that's going to be shown in the United States.
Are those paintings being shown in Sacramento as big as the paintings I'm seeing here?
Yes. There's going to be four paintings. approximately 6 by 8 feet, and there's a group of 16 paintings which are going to be much smaller. So it's
no small matter to transport them.
It's an issue. It's an issue. But, I mean, all of the work was shipped over here in July, and it's been in holding. And so I'm actually excited. I've not looked at those paintings since July when I was in Beijing. Mm. So all the work is here now. It's already been installed. And I will meet with the gallery owners this afternoon. I mean, if I could add a small plug, I mean, I think it's really courageous that Beth Jones and Linda Jolly is really producing this program, not just because of my work, but I think just presenting a great breadth of like abstract work, you know, in this area. I think we're all involved in education. I think with like fine arts, it's really great. And I think it's a really good opportunity for this community to actually visit, let's say, an exhibition of mine and or just to watch what this gallery is actually doing. I think it's just stunning what they produce.
Well, you have strong ties to Sacramento. Nevertheless, you live on the East Coast, right, and in China. How did it come about that this exhibit happens in Sacramento?
Well, I went to high school here. I went to elementary school. My parents are here, my extended family. So more or less, Sacramento is hometown, right? And the Beijing thing for me is really, it's about production. I think the majority of the world as it exists right now, people are mass producing things. So I can fly over to China, you know, hang out in the studio, make some paintings, you know, ship the work out. And it's okay. I think it really works well, you know, that way.
Can people see in your work, is there still in your work traces of your upbringing, your early upbringing in Jamaica?
I think it's always there. There's always indelible things that's burnt into one's brain, such as light, color, air, and space, the light that one would experience in the Caribbean, Jamaica. It's always in you. And I think the issue of like California light, I think that's in the work. I mean, now I'm in New England. There's a different kind of quality of light that exists there.
Sure.
And the light that's also in Asia, in China. I think all of us as human beings, we're really all a composite of all of our experiences. And it is in the work.
Why did your family leave Jamaica?
I think, you know, just the economy in Jamaica, it's hard. And I think, you know, my parents just thought that we would have more of an opportunity to actually come and grow and to be educated here in the U.S.
Do you and your parents go back to Jamaica much?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm hoping to be in Jamaica for New Year's this year. And if you have not experienced Christmas or New Year's in Jamaica, you haven't lived.
Oh, yeah?
I mean, it's Christmas lights on palm trees, the light, the color. I mean, it's magic. It's stunning. So, you know, all of those experiences, I mean, it does really climb, you know, into my work. And Jamaica's will remain, as long as I'm alive, you know, one of the most important issues, you know, for me. I think the place where you're born, that ground is always in you. You can't escape it.
Do you think you'll ever retire to one particular place, and where would that be?
I would like to retire in a place with a warm climate all year round. Perhaps it's Jamaica. Perhaps it's Hawaii. I mean, who knows? It could be the south of France. I mean, my wife would really love that, you know, but it's...
But not Beijing.
Probably not. I mean, I think the life over there, it's quite strenuous. I mean, it's hard, but, you know, Beijing is an interesting place to work, but yeah.
Peter Wayne Lewis, artist. He lives part of the time in the East Coast, but also in Beijing. There's an exhibit of his paintings at the JJ Art Gallery. Runs through December 23rd. There's a second Saturday artist reception tomorrow night from 6 to 9. Peter Wayne Lewis, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much.
And that's Insight for today and for this week. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Our theme was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Today's associate producers, Lynn Weaver and Liz Cazares. The assistant producer of Insight is James Morrison. The technical director, Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. And Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. We'll see you all next week. The amount of money it would take to fix Sacramento's aging sewer system could buy 6 downtown sports arenas, but the alternative could cost even more. On the next Insight, we'll talk with city officials about plans to replace more than 100 miles of rotting pipes beneath Sacramento. Also, Capital Public Radio's environmental reporter Joe Rubin talks about sea otters dying off in Big Sur and Davis's carbon-neutral West Village. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Monday morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.